This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listen to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Fantastic. Thank you, Victoria, for starting on our podcast. And as Victoria said, I'm your host, Scott Lunsford. We're here on The Felon File looking at law enforcement issues, crime and punishment, and the good guys, the bad guys, the not so good, good guys, the not so bad, bad guys, all kinds of different things, law enforcement and criminal justice wise. We focus a lot on the Appalachian Mountain areas, and we focus a lot on history. That being said, our shade of blue story for today, we're looking at 1927-1928. At that time frame, Charles Lindbergh's independent solo overseas flight from New York to Paris was pretty much the major headline worldwide. Stories and images of the Spirit of St. Louis made most of the front page in what was thought of at that time as a civilized world. The adventure of one man had made history. Unfortunately, that same family will be making history again with a shade of blue story that we will talk about at another time. Yet there is always an exception. At the start of 1928, stories of Lindbergh and his accomplishments took a backstage to a situation in Greenup County, Kentucky. The county of Greenup is on the edge of the Appalachian Mountain foothills. The situation at this time was the unfortunate death of a three-year-old girl in Aerolite, Kentucky. The child, Mary Magdalene Pitts, caught the consideration of thousands of individuals around the United States. People in Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Alabama, North Carolina, they traveled long distance to pay respects and find out more information about the child, how she had died, and attempt to help the family and attend the funeral and the trial. Yes, there was a trial. More than 19,000 individuals in some newspapers are reported to have viewed the little girl's body in her coffin. So many attending the funeral that it had to be moved to the county courthouse. Her coffin was placed in the bandstand. Her pallbearers were six little girls from the community who helped carry her coffin and laid her to rest. Even today, a lot of people still visit Mary's little grave in Riverview Cemetery in Greenup, Kentucky. Today's Felon File Shade of Blue, we're going to discuss the circumstances of a little girl's death. How did Mary Pitts die? Was justice found in the outcome? Was her father the worst, most evil dad in history? Well, let's listen to the story and you guys decide for yourself. It was 4 days after Christmas of 1927. Children in most families were still reeling from the excitement of the season, of course. Schools were still closed, and the novelty of presents received had yet to have left the children. Dr. George K. Woods, he was the community doctor in the rural county there in Kentucky. He had gone on to bed, feeling fortunate that the holidays had slowed his business somewhat. But the quiet was short-lived. His sleep was interrupted by a frantic pounding and young boys shouting at his front door. Opening the door, the doctor was confronted by two panicked young men, Herndon and Hubert Pitts, who frantically told the doctor that their little sister, Mary, was dead. Grabbing his bag he kept at the door, Dr. Woods, with the two young men in tow, proceeded to the cabin near the McCoy branch of Culp Creek. Arriving, the doctor was greeted with the body of a small girl, covered only with a bedsheet. And the home of the deceased child was a Mary B. Frazier, the Pitts family 32-year-old housekeeper. First confirming the death and that the emergency, for the most part, was over. Dr. Woods was also called on to prepare a body for burial, often for the interment on the family property the next day. People that could not necessarily afford an undertaker. Now, in his investigation, Dr. Woods noticed an unusual lack of emotion on the housekeeper's part. Another thing that the doctor found out of the ordinary in examining the child's body was that the dead blonde little girl was covered with scars, bruises, burns, and other injuries, including she had a hole in her head. Woods determined by body temperature and rigor mortis his estimate that she had been dead for several hours. Dr. Woods turned to the housekeeper, Marie Frazier, and demanded an explanation. What happened to her? I don't know, responded Frazier nonchalantly, but she wanted water a lot. After getting as much information as possible, Dr. Woods knew this was abuse, and to him, very serious child abuse and neglect. Leaving the Pitt cabin, he immediately went to awaken local law enforcement officers there in the county. In the morning, law enforcement and the county coroner visited the Pitts house. The family was about to hold the funeral services for little Mary in their yard. This was stopped. The body removed for further examination, and the housekeeper, Marie, was arrested. Being taken away, the housekeeper kept saying to the officers in the coroner, "She wanted water all the time. We did all we could to save her." Now, this didn't get very far with the coroner or the law enforcement. And not getting anywhere with the repeating this over and over, she changed her direction, yelling out that, quote, "I'll kill that coroner before we get to Greenup." Now, this, I'm sure, greatly assisted her position. I'm sure held a lot of weight with local law enforcement. A few days later, the little girl's father, Mr. Pitts, was also arrested. Dad was a 35-year-old man, Robert H. Pitts. He was a native of Estill County, Kentucky, who, by his own admission, would discipline his child with willow switches, pokers, razor straps, and other blunt objects. Yeah, good dad. The coroner completed his examination. Documentation on the death certificate spelled out in no uncertain terms what he had found, laying the facts down as well as some opinions. The death certificate read, the cause of death was as follows. Quote, probably shock resulting from burns, bruises, and cuts administered by the father and housekeeper. Probably a homicide. Contribution causes, exposure to cold without proper clothing. This was in reference to one of the little girl's hands, obviously frozen at one time. The autopsy revealed that the small girl had received a hard blow to the kidney and apparently been forced to eat pepper, which might have been the cause of the thirst that Marie Frazier, the housekeeper, noted. Coroner Compston had included the words, probably homicide. Later, when he testified in court that any one of the several injuries that he observed to the child could have been fatal, but during his visit to the Pitts home, he had been threatened not to list the death as a crime. But he told the court that was the conclusion that he drew. As is normal, it didn't take long for the local gossip to spread. Everyone suspected what occurred and had no problem voicing their own suspicions and opinions. The major rumor was that Mary had also been poisoned, but chemical analysis found no trace of poisoning that was conducted by the coroner. She had received so many injuries that medical experts never determined the precise cause of death, though some thought it was probably a blow to the head. The local funeral director documented his observations as he prepared the little girl for burial, writing for the police and the court a statement saying, quote, "I have been licensed as an embalmer since 1913, and in that time I have never seen a body in such shape. To my mind, this is the most brutal and horrible murder that could be committed. A helpless, defenseless baby murdered by the people to whom it should have sought protection from. No wonder the community is aroused. No wonder the people talk of a lynching." This is the statement he provided investigators. The case ended up going before a grand jury. After an actual bill was issued showing the grand jury found probable cause to send the case to court, the defense attorneys for Pitt and Frazier asked the judge to allow a bond to be set. The judge hearing the case denied the motion. Having heard the talk of the town, the public was now aware of how Mary had died and what had been done to her, while both alive and dead. He had no doubt, the judge did, that a lynching was going to be in order. As a matter of fact, an angry mob demanding justice had already formed around the county jail. An attack on the jail became such a concern that on January 5th, 1928, to prevent the growing crowd that called for a hanging to develop into basically an uncontrollable riot, local law enforcement quietly moved the two prisoners from the county jail to Winchester, Kentucky, the Clark County, Kentucky jail. Miss Frazier begged the officers to save her from the howling mobs. She had good reason to worry. Sheriff Edward Tinsley stated that the feeling was running so high, authorities considered taking both of them back to Clark County after the trial every day. Once confinement was made in Winchester, Robert Pitts and Marie Frazier began a series of attacks on each other. How they did this from lockup? It's a good question. Well, they used the written word and granting interviews with the press of the day. At times, each putting the blame on the other, as well as unidentified individuals and anything or anyone they could think of. Allegations running everywhere except for taking personal responsibility for the child's death. After the move, on January 9th, Frazier told a Lexington Herald reporter that she was guilty of nothing more than holding little Mary in her arms while she died, after and due to the whipping her father had administered. According to the reporter, Frazier used many colorful adjectives in her description of Pitts. Once that was published, not to let that stand, Pitts fought back with his own pen and paper. The two blamed each other for the crime. Pitts claimed it happened while he was at work. Frazier said the father beat her often for an extended period. At one point, even hinting at that he had allegedly killed a son previously. Pitts claimed Frazier, the housekeeper, was fearful that Mary's estranged mother, Lucy Walker Green, would return for Mary. That jealousy was a big problem for her. Frazier claimed that Pitts had been beating the child since she came to live with him. Pitts claimed that Frazier had told him she wanted Mary to die before her own child was born. And Pitts also claimed that Frazier thought she was saving Mary from a life of scorn because she was born out of wedlock. In the jail in Winchester, Pitts wrote a 54-page alleged confession in which he claimed he had consented to the murder after Frazier had, quote, "put dope in my coffee." He claimed that the housekeeper had left Mary hanging upside down in the barn once. She had been put in a burlap sack and was hung from a nail on a wall for hours. Pitts even had this confession, 54 pages worth, notarized. Now, Frazier, not to be undone, she wrote a 34-page confession. neither one of these really confessions. Basically, they were blaming each other. In hers, she claimed Pitts had killed the girl by hitting her in the head with a fireplace poker. Pitts wrote his daughter was already dead when he arrived home from his job at the American Rolling Mills Company in Ashland, Kentucky on December 29th. He observed indications Mary had been given a serious beating, that inference being that someone else must have done it. He could not have done it as he was not even there when it had occurred. Now, in this confession, Pitts claimed that Frazier begged him to marry her and that they had to get shed of the little girl, unquote. But he continued to disagree until, he said, Mary doped him up and being under the influence of some sort of drugs or narcotics, I consented to her doing anything she wanted to do, and I would protect her if she was caught. He continued in his statement that Frazier was to do away with Mary while he was at work. She begged him to drink coffee with her at breakfast, and she put the dope in his coffee. She also is claimed to have put drugs in a raisin pie, which he was to take to work. Pitts included these words in his confession. Quote, Mary got a rope and started for the house where we kept our cows. Me and my oldest boy followed, and when we got there, she had the rope around Mary's arm. She threw it over the corner of the house and pulled Mary up, swinging her and knocking her against the wall. I jumped up and caught Mary, cut the rope, and told her to go to the house. Pitts claimed that the housekeeper told Mary, your papa won't be here all the time, and sometimes when he is away, I'm going to kill you, and I'll bury you, and when he comes home, he'll think your mother came and got you. I told Marie that if she killed Mary, I would prosecute her. She was jealous of the child. He claimed when asked why he kept the housekeeper around, he stated that he didn't get rid of her because he was afraid she would kill Mary if he ordered her to go. Now, one of the jailers tasked with monitoring Pitts at the Clark County Jail found another written document or a partial confession in Pitts' pocket. Now, what is unusual about this document, which was later published, was that the writing style, the ink, and the writing tools used varied as you read the paper. It gave the serious impression from the varied writing styles and penmanship that two or more people had written the document. It was produced in court and the media was not able to print the entire letter due to the writing not only being offensive but on the paper, but it was unprintable in a newspaper. The document stated that the Pitts household sounded more like a family torture and house of horrors. The paper claimed Miss Frazier had killed Mary by rubbing her back with salt and turpentine after she had whipped him. Pitts also accused Frazier of trying to hang the little girl upside down, implying that she was so jealous of Mary that she had kept her from showing affection for her father. Now, after hearing all this, I'm sure you're kind of puzzled as to why Robert Pitts allowed the housekeeper to abuse his daughter, like he said and like he wrote. According to the text, though, he didn't. He took a stand for his daughter to protect her. He slapped Marie Frazier and whipped her with a switch to give her a taste of her own medicine, he claimed. The same document also described intimate relations between Pitts and the Frazier woman. This was according to the Lexington Herald, who obtained a copy of the last document. Both prisoners were provided quite a bit of stationery and pens to continue the written war of accusations against each other. Not to be outdone, though, Frazier told her own story of the father's actions. This is what she said. The night before little Mary died, I woke up and heard the child in her room. I asked her what was the matter. The next thing I heard was her scream. It was dark, and I hollered to Pitts and asked what the problem was. He told me to shut my mouth or I would find out. I believe that was when he hit her in the head with some hard iron. That morning before he started for work, he said he didn't know whether to go to work or not. He acted like he was in a deep study. On Saturday morning, September 10th, he had whipped little Mary for the first time, and from that day on, he whipped her every day, and sometimes twice a day. I had seen him hanging her on the door with her head down for over an hour, and she would scream, "Papa, Papa, let me down." Sometimes he would go to bed and leave her tied up by her little wrists to the ceiling for a while. I've seen him whip her back and legs until blood started flowing. Mrs. Fraser, who referred to little Mary as Hellcat and the Queen of Sheba, defended herself by writing new confessions and claiming she was, in fact, the only one who really cared about Mary. She was Mary's sole protector. Now, burns and injuries documented by the coroner and the funeral director on the child's body were attempted to be explained away by Mary's dress having once caught fire. It had been taking a bit of time to put the flames out, thus causing burn injuries to the little girl, according to housekeeper Fraser. Now, reading the latest salvo in the war of words between the two, Pitts replied that Fraser had poisoned the child with a disinfectant, potassium permanganate, which had caused her to die of thirst. Now, Miss Fraser admitted that Mary had been so thirsty just before her death that she had drunk cup after cup of creek water. Still, the allegations had nothing factual to hold on to. The autopsy had turned up no traces of any type of poisoning, and they had looked. Although, during the trial, a specialized chemist analyzed some of the contents of Mary's stomach that had been saved, and he did detect a poison that apparently she had consumed. The attacks on each other continued. The only profit of the attacks and allegations, really, was profit by the newspaper that published the arguments and the threats made by the father and the housekeeper. While all this was occurring, reporters wondered just where was Mary's real mother? Had she also been killed? Mary Magdalene Pitt's mother, Lucy Walker Green, was located. She was living with her brother-in-law in a houseboat on the Kentucky River near Boonesboro in Madison County, Kentucky. The media called her Mrs. Pitts and referred to her as being Robert Pitt's second wife, although in fact the two had never been legally married. Now, Miss Green spoke of Robert Pitts as an evil man in her interviews that the press did with her. Unsympathetic, a non-father, as he had been depicted before. She told the press that she had left him in June of 1927 after she couldn't tolerate his abuse anymore. At first, she had tried to take her daughter, Mary, with her, but Robert demanded the girl stay, and he emphasized his point by shooting at the mother, directly and indirectly, as she got away, running her off at the point of a gun. The mother ended up thinking that Robert Pitts had murdered their daughter out of spite, punishment for her not returning back to him. When the public discovered the child's natural mother was still alive, a fund was taken up to allow mom to attend Mary's funeral. Newspaper articles list that at least 5,000 people, though some say it was closer to 10,000 or 40,000, paid their respects to little Mary at the funeral home, where Mary's body laid in state for several days. The mourners came from Ohio, Virginia, West Virginia, Indiana, Tennessee, North Carolina, Michigan, Morgan, Illinois, all over the place. The story aroused such sympathy in the community that a local businessman by the name of Elwood Keener ended up donating a gravesite for the little girl to be buried in. Mary's casket was purchased by the workers of the CNO Railroad. The funeral was paid for by the workers at the CNO Railroad Terminal at Russell, Kentucky. The funeral was set for January 15th, and with so many planning or wanting to attend, the services, like I said, had to be held on the courthouse lawn. Even newsreel cameramen were present to film the event, to be shown in movie theaters across the country, if not overseas as well. Thousands solemnly passed the open casket placed on the bandstand to gaze for the last time upon the girl's calm features. In a searingly poignant touch, she held only a little doll. At the end of the day, a group of small girls acted as pallbearers at Riverview Cemetery. Other children carried the flower tributes. Hundreds followed the line of march. Mary Magdalene, who knew only hardship and suffering, was borne to her grave like a modern Cinderella. Statue of a tiny angel was erected on the gravesite. The base of the grave is the term, cruelly murdered. Now, the new confessions and accusation of Pitts and Frazier were released on January 13 to a very skeptical audience. This time, Mary Frances added that Pitts had struck his daughter on the head with a poker the night before she died. And because of this, Pitts produced a statement in which he named 24 men by name from the community that he claimed had been intimate with his, what the newspaper referred to as, a decidedly unattractive housekeeper. Perhaps he was attempting to imply that any of those two dozen men could have abused and murdered his daughter. Soon, though, he said he continued to pin the murder on his housekeeper, but noted that he had agreed to the crime after the villainess had poisoned him or drugged him. Miss Frazier replied, accusing Pitts of undetected second murder of a 20-month-old son. She ended her fourth confession. Nothing more was said of the second charge of murder, as it was presumed to be attempts to vilify Pitts even more by the housekeeper. That and the fact they couldn't find where another child had been born. He flatly denied the report that he had ever agreed to the housekeeper's plan to kill his daughter. Pitt labeled the statement that he had made previously fictitious. Pitts finally did make a partial confession of his guilt. He admitted that he sometimes beat his daughter, but he protested. He said he never hit her with anything larger than a switch about 15 inches long, and not more than three at a time. Adding to the story that he had yet to do so since Christmas Day. Okay, two or three days before Christmas, he hadn't beat her. The court adjourned after speaking with over 28 witnesses, including Mary's four half-brothers and half-sisters. Defense attorneys for the two asked for a change of venue, feeling that their clients could not get a fair trial where the crime had occurred. Well, Judge William Halbert postponed the trial, and he agreed that, to be fair, the venue needed to be changed, basing that on the number of people waiting to see the two so that they could avenge little Mary. The trial was transferred to Lewis County, the county adjoining Greenup. The two were tried separately. A rumor spread that Frazier was pregnant. A couple of doctors were brought in by the state, and they both found that the report was untrue. That and the fact that she had been locked up. On March 1st, Frazier pled guilty against the advice of her counsel. The lawyers didn't want her to do that. Though she lacked the quality of mercy, she threw herself at the court's mercy. She was acting on her mother's advice, Miranda Frazier, going against the attorney and to plead guilty. Her mother had convinced her that asking for mercy was the only way to save her life, and then gave her the standing also to blame Pitts most of the blame. Even more heinous charges were leveled by her. She claimed Pitts had told her he was killing Mary by inches. Pitts predictably made counter charges. Well, the jury took Frazier's word for it and found her guilty. and within minutes of being taken from the courtroom, the trial of Robert Pitts started up. Unlike Frazier, Pitts pled not guilty. An extraordinary act, since he had made a partial confession. No doubt he felt, as has many a murderer, that there is hope where there are soft-hearted juries, sentimental judges, and defense lawyers who excel at clouding the issues. Apparently, Pitts did not look outside his window. The people that were being chosen for his jury, a lot of those guys were already demanding he be hung. Unfortunately for Pitts, he faced a very wise jury and a very fair judge, and the attorneys had an uphill battle since the housekeeper had already been convicted. Not to mention the fact that Frazier was brought in as a witness against him, and her testimony was corroborated by the other children. She told many horrifying tales of the abuse of little Mary. Miss Frazier said that Pitts would hit the girl so long and hard with a razor strap that he would sink to the floor from exhaustion. She maintained that Pitts had administered the fatal blow by hitting Mary over the head with a poker, and her word seemed to be confirmed by a poker placed on exhibit. It was curved, suggesting that it had struck something with such force that the handle had bent. The crook of the poker fit a wound to a T in the girl's head. Doctors testified that the child's head wound was sufficient to cause death. The jury also saw photos of the girl's many injuries. The funeral director provided a life-size drawing depicting the wounds he noticed on the child when she was brought to him. The letter-writing habit Pitts had exhibited while in jail returned to haunt him. Prosecution displayed these same letters that he had written to Mrs. Frazier, in which he expressed concern that she was going to turn state's evidence against him, writing at one point, quote, "Baby, I will have two men testify that the jailer, Hammond, forced me to tell what I did. You and I will confess to three little switches. What you tell will clear me or convict me." When Pitts took the stand, he did what he always had done. He blamed everything else on Frazier and everybody else. He could not explain why he had not trouble calling a doctor when he allegedly came home from work on that December 29th and found that his daughter was dead. Pitts' sons, 13-year-old and 11-year-old, took the stand. The two boys told of having witnessed both their father and Miss Frazier abuse the 3-year-old half-sister often, just as the law had suspected they had. The prosecuting attorney told Pitts, "You have not shown as much interest in your baby as you would a hound dog. A hound dog would have known how to care for himself. A hound dog would have bitten you or just simply run away. But we are talking about a child." On March 3rd, both Pitts and Frazier were given life sentences. There was no appeal by attorneys on either side. Miss Frazier expressed hope that someday she might get paroled if she was a model prisoner. Should be interesting to note that the jury in the Pitts trial took only 15 minutes to reach a guilty verdict. Frazier was the first woman to get a life term in the state of Kentucky. Kentucky law allowed anyone given a life sentence at the time to apply for parole after serving 8 years. Frazier would serve 12 years in prison, being paroled in 1940. Pitts spent 14 years behind bars, let out of prison in 1942. Pitts lived a little while longer. He died in 1964 and was buried in Kansas City, Missouri. Frazier is thought to have lived until about 1985 near St. Petersburg, Florida, but she escaped public scrutiny later in life. The time and date of her death are not really sure. In 2004, plans for a movie about Mary were being put together. It was to be called As Fate Would Have It. Musician Billy Ray Cyrus was involved with it and said that he was going to be writing the screenplay. Local author from the area, David Spencer, was consulting. There was a problem with financing. The production company ran into some other issues and the plans pretty much fell through. But using money they had, the company did replace Mary's monument when the original monument to her was damaged by vandals in 2004. They broke the angel off of her tombstone. But it has been replaced. December 29th is recognized as Mary Magdalene Pitt's Day in Greenup, Kentucky, every year. A day to recognize child abuse issues and the suffering of small children. Christmas time, a good time of the year to think about the battles of good versus evil. And the young who sometimes are the unwilling casualties of this war. The question of justice is commonly debated. Who won true justice in this case? A little 3-year-old blonde child or an abnormally cruel woman and one of the worst fathers in the history of parenting? I think Mary's tombstone sums it up where it reads in large letters underneath the angel, Mary Magdalene Pitts, cruelly murdered. Not much more you can say to that. That's our Shade of Blue story for this week. Child abuse is a very serious situation. I've worked many cases as a juvenile investigator in my career. Way too many. And anything we can do to help prevent that from happening really needs to be done. This can be done in several different ways. Research them, decide what is best for you, and help join the fight. And also, in the meantime, you have the opportunity and it presents itself, do something nice for somebody, no matter who they are. It's really the right thing to do. And if more people did the right thing, maybe it would spread and we wouldn't have as much problems in the world as what we got. Well, in the meantime, be safe. Also, remember, in the coming weeks before we come back, in about 2 weeks, with another Shade of Blue story, be safe and be secure. Help somebody out. And if you'd like to, you can check out our webpage at scottlunsfordauthor.com or at felonfile.com or drop us an email at felonfile@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, Victoria, you're going to turn the control panel back over to you. You've got it, and close us out and we'll start working on our next project. Thank you for listening. Bye, y'all.
This has been The Felon File. A discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Numb books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee. Or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the web page to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.